Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Panning the Screen. My name is Dan Reichert. Sitting across from me is my wife, Bianca Reichert.
I am your wife, and that is my name.
That's your name.
Legally, that's my name.
It is, and I believe you are the expert, the resident expert of the subject we're going to be talking about this week, as we watched The Boy Band Con, the Lou Pearlman story.
I am an expert relative to you, but I am by no means an expert.
It is your current and always favorite genre is boy band. I see all the shirts you wear. I know it's, I assume all those bands are boy bands, right?
Yeah, Sun,
yeah.
Sleep, Typo Negative, they're all boy bands.
Yeah, okay. I mean, there are boys in them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, then nothing I've said is inaccurate. So this is something that you pointed out. This was something I had heard of Lou Pearlman because it turns out he was in the news several times in the last 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. And but I had no idea what his deal was outside of like, oh, I think he was like some shady manager of these boy bands.
Yeah.
But you heard about this and you seemed instantly pretty interested.
Yeah, because when I was a wee girl growing up in the suburbs of New Jersey, like many other girls my age, I was infatuated with these boys and these bands and the tunes that they would churn out. About how we were, you know, the love of their lives and how badly they wanted us and how they'd never break our hearts or anything like that. So it was, you know, a recipe for instant infatuation. And I was, you know, obviously very susceptible to that as a kid. It was probably like, I don't know, would have been 97, 98 that I was super into the boy band stuff.
Now, what percent of that fandom, and obviously the fandom, like, there is a real thing there. You see, you know, girls in the crowd screaming like it's the Beatles and the Ed Sullivan Show, which, I mean, you could argue the Beatles were totally a similar phenomenon, even though the music was totally different.
Right.
But, like, what percentage of your interest, or in general, the interest in boy bands from young girls is, like, oh, these are, like, cute boys versus this is about the music? Like, is it lopsided in one direction, or is it...
I can only speak for myself, and in my case, I really liked the music, and I was listening to the music all the time. And then, you know, like I said, they're singing stuff about, like, you feel like they're singing to you, because the lyrics are usually like, oh, I love you, you know, I'll never do anything to break your heart, this and that. So you feel like, you know, you're already kind of hot on these guys, you're really into the music they're singing. And then they're really cute. They're, you know, they all have, like, the thing about the boy bands is that there's, like, a boy for every type of gal. Like, there's, like, the edgy one, the clean-cut one, the darker one. You know, just like how they're Spice Girls, the different type of Spice Girls. It's kind of like that with the boy bands, too. It's less clearly defined, I think. But there's obviously the heartthrob, you know, the Nick Carter, the Justin Timberlake. But then there's, you know, the less obvious, but in my opinion, equally desirable, Kevin Richardson. And, you know, I'll go there and just say Joey Fatone. I think he's the unspoken sexiest NSYNC member.
Wow.
I'll say it. I mean, as an adult woman looking, maybe it's because when I look at those old pictures of NSYNC, he's the one that looks like a 30 to 40 year old guy.
Okay.
So for me, that's, you know, of all the boys, they all look like boys and he looks like a man. So
who was the one with the hat in this documentary that was featured? He had the tattoos on his neck and the facial hair.
That was AJ McLean.
Was he the bad boy of
Backstreet Boys?
Was he the bad boy?
He certainly was. Yeah.
Okay,
he was the bad boy.
Was any of that based on acts or personality, or was it just the look?
You know, I think it was like kind of like how in wrestling, you know, live the gimmick. I think like he had, like, he was predisposed to probably being a little more, you know, I don't know the word. I don't want to say badass.
Edgy,
okay.
Yeah.
And then they kind of incorporate that into his lyrics and his way of singing, because he always had tattoos, and he was always kind of like the, you know, wearing a wife beater when everyone else is wearing like a button-up shirt kind of guy.
It's interesting just thinking about this boy band phenomenon, because like what you're describing of like, oh, you're attracted to these guys and the music and stuff, like there were girl groups. There were like the Spice Girls and stuff, and they were attractive women and everything. But those fandoms were mostly women too, right? I mean, I feel like
all the boy band, girl bands, you know, just pop groups, I think they're all geared toward that like 10 to 14-year-old girl demographic. And obviously, as a young girl, I wasn't attracted to any of the Spice Girls because I'm not gay. But, I did identify with them. I thought they were really cool. And, you know, you want to be like them.
It's like that Pen 15 episode where they're all pretending to be Spice Girls.
Yeah, you want to be like them because they're cool. They're gorgeous. You know, they have interesting, quirky sense of fashion. And, you know, they sing songs, again, right to your heart, you know?
It's just interesting, though, that, like, there isn't a direct analog for boys of that age. Mm-hmm. I guess, are we all just whacking off to, you know, we're looking for porn and Playboys and stuff like that? Is that what we're doing and how we're getting that energy out in
girls?
Well,
I don't think of it as sexual energy. I just think of it as, like, because in all my time, you know, having a crush on Justin Timberlake or whatever, I don't think I've ever thought about, like, I want to have sex with him. It was always like, I want to hold hands.
Well, that's what I mean, though. It's like, do you feel like young girls were maybe more predisposed towards, like, ideas of romance and dating and stuff like that, where, like, guys of that age are just saying, like, we just want to see boobs? Like,
I think that applies to adult females and males, too.
I guess,
to a certain extent.
It's just weird that, like, that interest in that phenomenon just did not carry over across gender lines to boys. Like, boys did not have that.
Yeah, I will say, though, that the music, again, I can only speak for myself, but the music was a big part of my fandom. I really liked the music as a kid.
Huh.
Because it was super catchy songs, you know? They were really catchy. You could listen to them a billion times. And as a kid who makes $5 a year, you can only afford, like, one album a year. So
yeah,
you're going to listen to the shit out of it. But, I mean, young boys, I feel like, when you were a boy, what kind of music did you listen to? Is it
Zeppelin, Stones,
okay,
Beatles?
Yeah. See, I think you're probably an exceptional case because you had your father's influence. I think,
the boys my age, typically, there were a lot of, like, Smashing Pumpkins, some Rage Against the Machine, mm-hmm. Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a ton of rap. A lot of, like, you know, Bone Thugs and Biggie and Puff Daddy and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of, like, you know, really braggadocious, you know, like, music videos of them driving expensive cars and, you know, women everywhere. And
yeah, I think most pop music at any given time, at any given year, is geared towards that, like, 10 to 15-year-old demographic, you know, girls or boys. I think because that's, you know, the kind of people that, like, appreciate pop music to the point where they'd be screaming in crowds are probably simpler and don't have, you know, aren't hardened by life to appreciate, you know, the darker, deeper music, you know?
It reminds me of earlier this year, Halsey hosted SNL, and she said something like, oh, yeah, a lot of you probably don't know who I am, but if you hear angsty music coming from your, like, 13-year-old girl's bedroom, that's me.
Mm.
So, I mean, I wonder if that's, like, a modern example of that type of thing.
Yeah. By the time I was 13, I was over the pop stuff.
Yeah.
For sure.
Was it a direct transition into, like, death metal?
No. My brothers, I think I mentioned this on a podcast before, but my brothers would download songs on Napster and LimeWire and stuff, so I was exposed to a lot of music that way, and just my brothers were always super into music. I think it was kind of a slow transition. Like, I always liked a few songs from random, like, metal and rock bands, even in the midst of my, you know, being a fan of pop music. And I think as I got older and wanted to be more rebellious or whatever and wear black clothing, I started to listen to The Distiller. My first big foray into rock music was Nirvana. I was absolutely obsessed with Nirvana. And then I got into, like, Distillers and more punk rock music and then more, like, just metal. And, you know, from there, prog metal, death metal, tech death, etc.
So during your boy band years, so I wrote down several of the bands that Lou Pearlman discovered or managed or, you know, robbed or whatever. And it was the obvious ones, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, which I feel like anyone knows, you know, even if you never listened to
right.
them. And LFO, they had the, was that the I Like Girls Who Wear Abercrombie and Fitch?
And that's the only song I know from them.
So they were a one-hit wonder. There was O-Town, which I vaguely remember, because my sisters, my little sisters, were really, really, really into all of that, too. They were into NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Spice Girls. And I remember my sister Kayla had an O-Town poster.
Yeah.
They were different than 98 Degrees, right? 98
they
Degrees.
Were.
I don't think 98 Degrees were Lou Pearlman, but they were definitely of that ilk, right?
They were, yeah, definitely. That was Nick Lachey. And
that's right.
Guy. But O-Town, yeah, they were from Making the Band, which is the show that Lou Pearlman produced after the BSB and NSYNC stuff that we'll obviously address. But O-Town, I remember they had the song Liquid Dream, which was, like, obviously about waking up with cum all over you as a guy.
Right.
But that was their song. And then they had that All or Nothing, which I think was their biggest song. So they were really, I mean, their name was O-Town.
Oh, was it all, like, thinly veiled sex stuff that?
See, I said that, like, thinking O-Town was a really long, lame name, but are you saying that it might be, like, an orgasm town?
I thought that's what you were implying, was that the band's name is Orgasm Town with their hit single, Wet Dream.
One way ticket to Orgasm Town.
Was that one of their singles?
No, but yeah, they were really unbelievably lame. It just seemed like after BSB and NSYNC, it just got so contrived. Like, here was the formula. And then, you know, in the mid-2000s, that got, I think everyone recognized that we were over that collectively. And now I feel like the boy band stuff, the girl band stuff, it's a lot of, like, I'm talking contemporary music now, it's a lot of K-pop groups that I hear about. I mean, granted, I don't really follow pop. I think there was, what was the name of that band that did that song, that was all over some WWE pay-per-view, the Women's Evolution one, Little Mix. And then there was the group that had, what's her face? Camila Cabello, the Havana girl.
Oh, what was that? They did a WrestleMania too. Not One Direction. One Direction was boys.
That was a boy group.
Fifth Harmony.
Yeah. Yeah. And then everything else I'm familiar with, or not familiar with, but just know the name of, is like K-pop stuff.
I know there was a band that just did SNL, and I think it was like five young Korean boys, and they were
BTS,
like,
yeah.
BTS, I guess they're huge.
Yeah, they are huge. I've never heard one of their songs, but
I don't think I have either.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's interesting to see. It's, you know, I as someone who grew up with musicians who are, like, you know, jazz musicians, incredibly talented people, half of me, like, is just like, oh, this is so fucking lame. All these kids have to do sing someone else's song and learn how to dance, and they'll be multimillionaires. Meanwhile, my brothers aren't so fortunate. But the other part is just interesting to see the evolution. Like, why is it that this group, this boy band, in the midst of all these other boy bands, is the one to make it so far? Especially in, like, Korea, where there are companies that, like, just, it's like a assembly line. They just shit these bands out, these groups out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, once someone gets, like, 25 years old, they replace that person with another, you know, younger. And yeah. These people can't date. They can't. It's a completely foreign way of doing things.
Isn't that, like, Menudo? Isn't that where Ricky Martin is from? Aren't they, like, still around and they just, like, Menudo? Swap members out?
Menudo isn't a K-pop group.
Not K-pop, but, I mean, weren't they, like, a boy band? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, and they constantly, like, swap people out once they get too old or something?
Yeah. Huh. I don't know. It's unfortunate because any group of young men or women, or old men or women, doesn't matter, automatically gets that boy band, girl band label. But I think in some cases, it's like they're a group of people because harmonizing is their thing and they want to do a bunch of harmonies. Like Boys to Men, for instance,
right.
A lot more, a lot of harmonies and stuff. It wasn't just like pop music. That was obviously R&B, but it was very, like, they needed all those people in the band in order to make the sound they were making. But
now another one of them was Innocence, which
I never heard of that group before.
I didn't know if they were big and I just never heard of them, but they interviewed one woman from there and they were also managed by Pearlman, which I looked them up and I guess Britney Spears was in it for like a second and then she went off and did her solo thing. But that kind of brings us to what this actual documentary is.
Right.
So Lou Pearlman, the mastermind behind a lot of these bands, and again, like, even if it was just NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, like, those are the two that I think are synonymous with boy bands. He was the one who found them and made them famous and everything, but also kind of royally screwed them all over.
Right.
And so there's a lot of people involved that did interviews for this movie that were part of those bands. Lance Bass, probably most majorly, because he produced. Mm-hmm. He produced this documentary. His mom is in it a lot. There's a lot of Lance Bass. There are several of the NSYNC. You don't have Timberlake.
Yeah, you have Timberlake's mom.
Yeah, she's in it.
She's in it.
So then JC Chavez,
yeah,
he was NSYNC, right?
He's NSYNC. Chris Kirkpatrick was in it. He's NSYNC.
Right.
And I think the only Backstreet Boy was AJ McLean.
Right, and they even hinted at how, like, some of them, like, was it the Kevin guy who lost his father and he kind of viewed Lou Pearlman as a father figure?
Yeah, so this Lou Pearlman guy, he wasn't just, like, a manager that they would go see in the office once a month to give updates to or whatever, producer, I don't know. But he was, like, really involved in these kids' lives. Like, he, you know, they're a bunch of young boys, like, probably 15 through 20 years old, really young guys. He puts them up in their own house, you know. Amazing food all the time, fun things to do. Like, their every need is being met, and then they get a $35 per diem. But they're not really seeing any of the money from the enormous amount of money that their music is making, despite their huge success. I mean, Backstreet Boys, that was a pretty meteoric rise. NSYNC, in the beginning was, I think, not as huge in the beginning, but then, like, instantly after this one Disney performance apparently became, like, huge. So Perlman was managing these two bands simultaneously, even though they were obviously competing with one another, which was weird. Can you imagine, like, the guy you see as a father figure is, like, helping you on one hand and then helping your competitors on the other hand.
And actively playing them against each other at times.
So after many years under his wing, they eventually meet at a restaurant to be presented with their checks. And Lance talks about, like, wondering, like, oh, is it going to be? Because they have no idea how much money it's going to be.
No, but they know that they've been selling out stadiums.
Yeah,
and that
all they know
breaking
is that,
records.
Exactly, they have maybe millions of screaming fans at this point.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, it's going to be $1 million. It's going to be $500,000. You know, they had these dreams of it being a ton of money, which it should have been. But they open the checks and it's only $10,000.
Yes.
So the question is, where is this money going? So they look at their contracts. They bring their contracts to lawyers and stuff. And as it turns out, in addition to collecting as a producer and manager, he was also collecting as the sixth band member. So he was making way more than any of the guys, the boys, despite doing, you know, a lot of work, but not nearly as much. They deserve a tremendous amount of money for what the work they were putting in, for sure.
So I was kind of confused by that sixth band member perk, because, like, at first I was like, oh, so does that mean he just got another $10,000? But, or did that mean, like, oh, a certain amount is allotted for the talent, and as technically a sixth member, he was able to just, like, funnel so much of that towards himself and then just leave them with, you know, scraps?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about the details of the contract, because they don't really go into the ins and outs of it in the documentary. They only kind of talked broadly about it, but ultimately the contracts were just super unfair.
Yeah.
And, you know, these kids, they were relatively unknown. I think, like, Justin Timberlake was in Mickey Mouse Club, and some of them might have history in the Disney, you know, Disney theme parks. There's all Disney stuff in Florida, which is where they were located. But they certainly weren't, like, celebrities that would be chased down the street or anything like that.
They even, like, there's that scene on the bus, which is kind of funny looking at it now, where Justin Timberlake is, like, kidding around and lying about, like, oh, look, here they are. They're running after the bus. And then the other people are like, oh, yeah, you pretend like you have fans.
Right.
And look at it now. And, like, there certainly would be people chasing after Justin Timberlake.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But so these kids, you know, they obviously had, you know, they wanted to be famous. They wanted to sing and dance for people, I guess. And they saw an opportunity in the newspaper, and they took it. And I think, you know, maybe they didn't have the experience. They were just so excited. Their parents were excited for them that they didn't have a lawyer or third party look at the contract. Maybe they felt like if they put up any resistance to the contract that they would just be replaced with another boy, which probably would have been the case. And ultimately, you know, even though they were screwed over, they've probably seen a lot more success than they would have if Lou Pearlman didn't put that ad in the whatever back page of whatever thing. So
yeah, because I remember when my sisters were super into it, they had the No Strings Attached poster as well. And I, knowing nothing about the band, didn't know that that was referring to, you know, Lou Pearlman and them cutting him loose and suing him and everything.
I didn't know that either until watching this.
And that's interesting because, like, I feel like when that came out and my sisters were listening to that album all the time, that that was kind of like the height of how crazy pop culture was for NSYNC. So, like, obviously they saw huge success after Pearlman, and Timberlake obviously went off and did his own thing.
Right.
But it's crazy how he put forth this illusion, Pearlman did, of, like, giving these kids this Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, you know, experience. But all that money that they thought, like, oh, he's treating us to these fancy steakhouses and all this stuff, it was all coming out of what the band
was
making. So, like, he was not treating them to that. Like, that was their money that they earned. And they talk about, like, having to go down to these warehouses in Orlando and practice for, like, 8, 10, 12 hours a day, just sweating their asses off. Like, he was working them to the bone and kind of reaping all the rewards.
Right. Yeah, it's hard because undeniably what he did sucked.
Yes.
But if he didn't exist, you know, maybe NSYNC wouldn't exist. Maybe Backstreet Boys wouldn't exist.
Right.
Know? So it's, you know, he obviously was a really smart guy, an evil genius, because he was doing, like, con man kind of stuff long before the boy band stuff happened. He always had a fascination with aviation.
Yeah.
So he went on to found his own, like, aviation company, whatever, blimp, making blimps and stuff. And he had this deal with Jordache Jeans to advertise Jordache on this blimp, which is supposed to be a big deal. I guess it's a big deal back then to put ads on things.
Yeah, certain brands certainly were synonymous, like Goodyear and MetLife and stuff. Yeah.
So he makes this blimp himself that ends up being really shoddy and kind of people suspect that it was purposely shoddy so that it could crash and that he could reap the insurance from it. So that was, you know, a first questionable practice, or one of the first. And through his aviation company, he became familiar with New Kids on the Block, which is what inspired him to pursue the boy band stuff. But I think his worst, most evil thing happened after the boy band stuff. You know, that gets the most publicity because there's celebrity attached to it. But I don't know if you want to get into that now or...
Yeah, you're referring to the Ponzi stuff, which, yeah, we should definitely talk about. But, like, a little before that, they kind of touch on some stuff, but don't really go too deep on some, like, sexual misconduct allegations.
Right.
Where, like, some people, including Lance Bass, who is highly, highly critical of Lou Pearlman, I guess in interviews, not in this documentary, he claims that there is no sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. Aaron Carter is the one, like, really pro-Lou Pearlman guy in this documentary.
Yeah, he's pro-Lou Pearlman, but it comes across, it's almost like him being so just intensely pro-Lou Pearlman is kind of making the other people's arguments seem more valid. Because it's like the only person defending him is this person who's seems a little unhinged.
A little bit, yeah.
In his defense, I think that he was going through some like drug and eating disorder stuff at the time that this was recorded. So he was, you know.
Not in his right mind.
But I mean, he obviously was very beneficial to these guys' lives in some ways, even though, you know, at the end of the day, it was ultimately his own greed that prevailed over the well-being of these kids that kind of considered him like a father figure.
Yeah. And there's a few specific things that they say, like he had cameras all over the house and was like
strange,
filming the Innocence girls like tanning and then offering it to the boy bands like, hey, come over and check this out. I got footage of these girls naked and stuff. And like, you know, weird unwanted massages and stuff like that. It certainly never goes into like Michael Jackson territory type stuff. But they kind of touch on this stuff. But it's weird because I feel like the documentary is kind of like, here's the early life and him kind of scheming people. Here's him getting into the boy band industry. Mm-hmm. Here's the Ponzi scheme stuff. But then there's this thing kind of in the middle. It gets like 10 or 15 minutes of just like a little mention. And it's like, wait, okay, are we just – like nothing ever really came of that.
Yeah, the only person that had a story, like an actual story that he shared publicly is this guy Rich Cronin, who has since passed away. But one of the O-Town guys retells a story about how like, you know, Lou Pearlman essentially went to him and told him to kind of practice – jerking him off or something like that. But it's in this day and age when, you know, we tend to favor victims, I think it's important to not just flagrantly throw stuff out there because even though, you know, he's obviously a bad guy and I would not doubt what these kids are saying, these men are saying. But still, if you don't have, like, actual concrete proof, if all you have is, like, one anecdote that was shared in the Howard Stern show, it's probably best to not delve into that, because also it raises so many questions and this documentary isn't necessarily about that. Like, there's so much like obviously provable bad stuff that he did. You know, I don't think if you want to explore that, then, you know, maybe they should do that elsewhere in a more well thought out way than just a few asides.
I think that's why I think it felt odd in this because it seemed to be so kind of shortly touched on without any kind of deeper dive on stuff that I was like, wait, okay, I guess we're just moving past this. Mm-hmm. Like it felt a little off the subject matter. And again, like if that was a big part of him, like, yes, they should dive into that and figure out what the hell was going on there. But like, why bring it up in this documentary about like more of the Ponzi type, you know, schemes if they're not going to really spend the time to get to the bottom of that?
Yeah.
You know?
And they don't really talk about Lou Pearlman's personal life at all, than this like allusion to him being interested in the boys. But
yeah.
So it's just a weird thing to attach to it.
Yeah. But as you were going to say, like it then kind of moves into the latter part of this documentary, which is the bigger super criminal thing.
Oh, yeah. Just real quick. I just want to mention, I forgot to say this, but after the boy band stuff went down, he bought this Options Talent Group. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't think so.
So I remember being at the Garden State Plaza and there would be like kiosks and every now and then like you would see someone flag some, you know, cute looking guy or girl down and like, you know, talk to them about modeling or whatever the fuck. And either this was that or something very similar, but it was this Options Talent Group. Pearlman bought it And it was essentially a giant photo mill scam. So people, you know, people who think, oh my gosh, I could be a model, they shell out a ton of money for a photo shoot. Then they never get any calls or anything because they just keep the money.
Do they get the prints?
Like, I don't even know that. I don't know that.
So it was basically a scheme of like, hey, we're going to take these pictures and then shop them around for you, but they just take the pictures.
Right. And collect the money from the photography. Yeah.
This dude sucks.
Yeah, it's really lame. But ultimately, this Ponzi scheme was his downfall. So do you want me to just run through what it entailed?
Yeah.
So it was a really long-running Ponzi scheme that lasted for like over 20 years. It defrauded people out of more than $300 million. So he had this Transcontinental Airlines company, but it only existed on paper. It was a shell company. Is that the right word for that?
I think so. I had to look up the Wikipedia for Ponzi scheme just to figure out what that was. So.
Yeah. So he enticed people to invest in Transcontinental Airlines, a company that didn't exist. He had falsified FDIC documents, AIG, Lloyd's of London documents to, you know, inspire people to, you know, project this legitimacy that wasn't there.
Which that was interesting for me because I have only heard of Lloyd's of London in one context. Are you familiar with this?
No, what?
Wrestling. So a group of wrestlers back in, I want to say the late 80s, early 90s, kind of before my time. I know Rick Rude was one of them, took out insurance policies that would basically pay out huge if they got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know the specifics. It was before my time, but I know a lot of guys got paid a ton of money,
mm-hmm.
basically like taking out these Lloyd's of London policies and then being like, oh, I got hurt at my job here. And they got paid out huge.
And they were part of the WWE at this time?
I don't want to say anything confidently. I just know that like huge names of the era, mm-hmm. and Rick Rude is the one I can confidently say, but there were several others, mm-hmm. maybe Kurt Hennig. But I want to look that up, but like that is the only thing I'd heard of Lloyd's of London about.
Yeah.
So hearing it brought up in this, I was like, oh, okay, apparently this was a bigger thing than just like a weird wrestling scam.
Oh, interesting. And it was a scam. They weren't actually hurt.
I believe so. And if I remember right, I think some of them had to like stay off TV or stay out of the ring for a few months and to kind of keep it kayfabe. Wow. with the injury. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's wild. So he also used fake financial statements to secure bank loans, and they showed pictures of these statements on the documentary, and they looked legit. I mean, if you know, it's really unfortunate. These people are investing their life savings. You know, this one couple, the lady's mother passed, and she invested all the money that was left to her into this. And, you know, just a bunch of really sad stories like that. It's not people investing extra money. It's people investing the money that they worked for their entire lives.
Yeah, and Perlman was just so actively, you know, fooling these people. Like, he knew what he was doing. He was taking fake shots of, like, a little model plane mm-hmm. above a runway and keeping his fingers out of the frame mm-hmm. and just be like, hey, look, here's one of our planes landing here. You're just taking off. Like, he knew what he was doing. This isn't one of those things where he was just, like, ignorant and like, oh, I was running a business and not doing my tax stuff right or something. Mm-hmm. It was, like, he knew what he was doing and he was robbing people.
Right, yeah. And I would just think, though, that, like, with his history, you know, I mean, granted, it did last for long before the boy band stuff happened, but you would just do some research on the man himself. I mean, what he was saying seemed really too good to be true. I'm not saying that the people that invested are stupid. They were obviously taken advantage of, but just do your due diligence before investing in stuff, I guess, right?
There is a type of person that is just like this habitual grifter that, like, you know, think about the Fyre Festival guy, mm-hmm. where it's just like that's all they know is like they don't know how to make an honest dollar. They just have to like get all of their money off the backs of other people from just fooling them or robbing them, or it's just, and they move from one thing to another. I mean, you look at Lou Pearlman here, starting with his blimp crap and moving on mm-hmm. to the boy bands and cheating them out of stuff and moving on to just like average people and the Ponzi scheme stuff.
If he would have invested that much effort into doing things, not even necessarily for the greater good, but just earning an honest dollar.
Yeah.
You know, he could have made millions that way. And it's like the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys stuff, they made so much money. If he would have taken a fair slice, that would have been enough for him to retire. You know what I mean? It would have been millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, he could have done it 100% above board and just like, hey, he obviously had an eye for business and talent and stuff. He did put together these bands and saw the potential they had.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like you said, he could have stayed on as their manager mm-hmm. and maybe they could have lasted longer. There certainly wouldn't have been lawsuits that he would have had to settle and pay out for, wouldn't have wound up in prison. Like if he would have just – and how much money do you need? We saw his house. We saw how crazy and lavish his lifestyle was. He was doing fine. Why not just keep it above board and just do it honestly? I don't think people like us can fathom that level of like greed and wealth that like – at a certain point, aren't you good? Like, do you really need to do this?
It doesn't make any sense to me. It's just beyond my comprehension why $10 million isn't enough. Like, why is that not enough money? Yeah, it's the music industry is really, it's super shady. I mean, you have these people that are, for a lot of people, you know, their music is everything to them. They invest their time, their lives, their feelings into making music. And they're in a vulnerable position when someone comes along and says, you know, here, you sign this paper, we'll distribute your records, you know, we'll take care of all this stuff for you. And then they take most of the money, like most of it. It's just bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers.
I think you hear about it a lot, too, from, like, child stars in Hollywood where their parents, you know, like, didn't Britney Spears' parents kind of screw her over? And I know, like, Macaulay Culkin's parents did. I thought there was some weird thing with, like, Britney Spears and her father. Didn't he manage her business when she was too young to do that?
I don't know about her parents, like, taking money from her. I do know that she's under a conservatorship of her father after she had, like, that breakdown in, like, the mid-2000s.
Huh.
But I'm not sure about the money stuff. But, yeah, I mean, that's it's a tale as old as time.
Yeah,
I mean,
people taking advantage of people who don't know better.
Yeah. They're young kids who are child actors raking in a ton of money that they obviously don't know what to do with.
No.
You would think the parents would invest most of that money and then use the rest to take care of the kid. But, you know, I mean, a lot of parents just see their kids as money-making things, you know, as access gateway to a greater lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, we watched that Michael Jackson documentary on HBO, Leaving Neverland.
Leaving or Finding?
I think Finding Neverland is a different thing.
Okay.
But, you know, these parents were letting their young boys hang out with Michael Jackson, sleep in his room, you know, unaccompanied, no one watching over them, you know, and it's just, how could you let that happen? How could you be so ignorant, you know?
One of the things that I really think about when I think of that phenomenon of, like, parents using their kids mm-hmm. is, I haven't seen it since the theaters, but, you know, Bruno, that Sacha Baron Cohen movie.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there's a scene where I can't remember which character he's playing, but he's trying to, like, talk to parents and be like, hey, this is an audition for your kids. And he keeps bringing up all these things, like, would you be okay with your kids doing this extremely dangerous thing, this thing? It's been so long since I've seen it. I don't remember the specifics, but it's, like, in Sacha Baron Cohen form, like, cartoonishly,
right.
Like, oh, would you let your kid dangle over a pit of alligators? That's not an actual thing. But, like, these parents are just like, oh, yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. And it's just like, holy crap.
Unbelievable.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
Yeah, but I don't know. It seems like things, I mean, Pearlman got what was coming to him. It seems like the Backstreet Boys, we were just in Vegas not too long ago, and I saw a huge ad for them performing. It looks like all five of them are still doing their thing, which actually surprised me. I thought NSYNC was bigger than the Backstreet Boys, but then I read that the Backstreet Boys sold way more records than
NSYNC.
Oh, yeah, it was like 130 versus 70 or something.
Oh, wow. Well, the Backstreet Boys, I think, have way more records than NSYNC. I think NSYNC just has like three albums.
Gotcha.
But yeah, that's surprising. I mean, Justin Timberlake was obviously the biggest star that came out of any of this.
Yeah.
But maybe Backstreet Boys did have more hits. I mean, I think I Want It That Way was like ubiquitous when it came out. It was fucking everywhere.
And maybe I'm skewed just because my sisters, I think, were more into NSYNC. So maybe I just saw and heard of them way more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, good for them. I mean, it's, you know, they don't have to make new music. They have such a huge catalog of hits as is. Oh. It's like they are, those kinds of bands are just built to, in later life, have a residency at Las Vegas. Because you have all these people who were fans of them when they were in their prime. Now they have expendable income, you know. They can run down all their greatest hits in one show. Yep. You know,
you always hear about like, oh, New Kids on the Block or whatever, like the nostalgia tour. And it's just like all these, they were 12-year-old girls back then, but now they're 30. And yeah, like you said, they've got income and they're going to go, you know, relive their youth. And sure, of course, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even into the music, obviously, anymore. But if I had like an opportunity to go to that Backstreet Boys show, I probably would, just for nostalgia's sake. You
totally.
Know? Yeah.
Yep. But overall, by the way, I think we forgot to mention this was on YouTube Originals, which this is the first one we've done of those. So this is YouTube's premium service thing. I don't think you can get it a la carte or anything, but if you happen to have YouTube's premium service, you can watch this on there.
They have like a free trial kind of thing if you want to just get in, watch some stuff, and get out. But Perlman died in 2016.
Oh, yeah, we should probably mention that guy sucks and he's dead.
He's dead.
Yeah, he was like 62. He was, if you have not seen the documentary or pictures, he was a big fat guy and had heart problems. And died in prison. Mm-hmm. So we got a good 8 years in there before he got out.
Yeah.
Yep.
So. But he would have gotten out I think last month or something if he was alive. Which is
no, it was like 2029.
Crazy. Oh, I thought it was 2019. Oh, okay.
No, it's 2029. The judge mentions in the documentary that he said for like every million that you defrauded out of people, if you give it back, I'll take a month off. But they never really followed up on if that ever happened. But yeah, even once he went in, he was trying to figure out how to get the internet and phone calls so he could like do another scheme or something from inside prison. Which again, Fyre Festival, like. These type of guys just don't know how to stop doing that.
Use that entrepreneurial instinct for something good that doesn't scam people.
Yes.
I mean, or at least just try to do that. But overall, I think this documentary was interesting because I've always been curious to learn more about what happened. I think it was weirdly paced. Like, it went from like talking about the boy band stuff to then cutting back to his like childhood life and his friends and stuff. I think that it would have been better if it was condensed to like a 1 hour documentary or something, because I feel like, you know, they could have trimmed a lot of fat there.
Yeah.
And it was a little lopsided as far as its coverage of the boy band stuff versus the Ponzi scheme stuff, because I think that was a lot worse. But obviously the boy band stuff has celebrity attached to it.
And there's a little bit of whiplash between like they start out with the boy band stuff and then it's like, and here's him growing up in Queens and blimp stuff. And then it's like, oh, boy band stuff. And then a brief thing of the sexual misconduct. And then, oh, now we're doing this Ponzi scheme. It just kind of bounces around abruptly.
I feel like at that point when they started talking about his life as a child, you already hate him because they told you what he did. So it's like, why do I care? I don't care about this guy. I kind of zoned out a little. I think it could have been rearranged and the pace would have been better and it would have been a little more, you know, interesting.
It was an interesting story. I liked hearing from the people that were directly screwed by him, you know, like hearing what they had to say. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see some people be way harsher about things and some people being more forgiving about things. Overall, interesting story.
Right.
Documentary was all right.
Right.
I wouldn't say it was like amazingly made.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was glad to watch it and learn more about his story.
Indeed.
Yes. You know what? He was a notorious grifter.
Mm-hmm.
We here on Painting the Stream, we're above board. We're going to tell you exactly what we're asking for money for.
What are we asking for money for?
Well, that's our listener support program that helps us keep the lights on here at this podcast. Yeah. And we're not asking for millions. We're asking for, if you want to go to paintingthestream.com.
We're asking for fives or ones.
You can do a one. We have, actually, I think we have certainly more people at the $1 level than anything else. And we are thankful for every single person who participates
here.
Every
schmacka.
Every one of them. So yeah, like we say, you can do $1, $5, or $10 a month, or you can do it one time and then cancel it. If you go to paintingthestream.com and click support this podcast, you can do it on Apple Pay on your phone. You can do it secure with credit card on the website. But that helps us out a lot. It shows that you're enjoying the podcast and you want us to keep moving. I think we're coming up on like 60 episodes here every single week for you.
Wow.
So if you want to help keep that train rolling, go ahead and go use our listener support function on paintingthestream.com. And for every person that supports us, we give you a customized personal Bonku.
Indeed, we do.
Bonk, do you have one? Do we have a supporter?
We do have a supporter, Daniel.
Okay.
His name is Tom, and I wrote a haiku for him that I would like to share with you and our listeners. Is that okay?
Yes, I think Tom would be happy to hear it.
All right, let's do it. Wind cuts through the trees and into the dense, wet air. Tom smiles. Spring is here.
Oh, wow. That's really good. That's really good.
That's for you, Tom.
Oh, that's very nice. I hope you enjoyed it, Tom.
You might have a mustache, and if you do, it's spectacular.
Okay.
Maybe you have giant gorilla hands that have once or twice held my child hands because you might be my dad.
Oh, okay. You might have met this Tom. Okay. I'm glad we said it was spring on this one, mm-hmm. knowing that it's going up next week, because we were just hearing the one that went up last week, the Paris House episode. We heard this morning because your mom was listening to it in Jersey, mm-hmm. and we had just gotten back from a trip. And so we had this one banked Terrace House episode, and we were just walking around the house this morning, and we hear us talking about bonkus on the podcast, being like, oh, I think we could call a bonk haiku a bonku, right? I think after like we've probably done like 15 episodes where we've called them bonkus. So yes, last week's was in the can. This one is fresh, and so will next week's.
Mm, fresh pod.
Yes.
So refreshing.
Before we go, do you have any suggestions for the folks at home?
I do, Daniel. Okay. And I think you might agree with this suggestion.
I think we might have the same one. We haven't talked before.
I don't think we do. Mine's very specific. No. Okay. So we were on a trip on vacay last week, and we stopped at a bar in Arizona also sold liquor there. You could buy like cases or bottles of liquor.
Because Utah has weird liquor laws, and it's like you can only buy like 1% beer between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. on a Tuesday. And it's like you got to cross the border to Arizona if you want to get real booze.
Right. So we got this Deep Eddy lemon vodka, and it was more like – it wasn't like a vodka that I've ever tried, because it was kind of a drink in and of itself. It was like sweet, and it's apparently made with like real lemons and not artificial flavoring. But it's so fucking good. If you ever see it in the store, definitely grab a bottle of it and make this cocktail that Tim Turry made for me. It's amazing. It's this lemon vodka, orange juice, and lemon seltzer. You mix that baby up, put a little straw in there. We didn't have straws, but it would have been so good with a straw. And it's a great, you know, vacation drink. It's very refreshing.
Yeah.
So Deep Eddy lemon vodka. Get it. This is not an advertisement.
It never is an advertisement.
This is just me speaking from my heart.
And you're not even a big booze connoisseur, but I remember you drank that and you're like, oh my God, this tastes great.
Yeah, it did taste great. I enjoyed it.
My suggestion also comes from our trip. We spent a lot of time playing board games and having a lot of fun on our vacation. Mm. And old Ben Hansen of Game Informer and GameInformer.com, mm-hmm. he has always been a really consistent board game recommender to me and Bonk.
He's introduced so many amazing games.
Avalon, Codenames, all sorts of games that we play pretty regularly. But we got a new one that we just ordered thanks to Ben Hansen's recommendation. It is called Azul. And I assume if anyone listening to this knows anything about board games, you've probably heard of it, because he said it was one of the biggest like award-winning board game of last year. I had never heard of it, so it was new to me. If it is new to you, check out Azul. I'm not going to go into describing how it works. It involves strategy and moving tiles around and earning points.
There's an element of luck.
An element of it, but there definitely is some strategy mm-hmm. involved. Bonk, you just smoked us numerous times. it is an incredibly satisfying game. I really like everything about it. So I would suggest check out Azul.
I second that suggestion. It's a great game.
Yes. And that'll be it. If you want to give us feedback or recommendations or anything, you can email us at panningthestream@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @panthestream, and that's where we will let you know what we're going to be covering for the next week if you want to watch along with us, or you can always just tweet at us, give us recommendations that way. I also want to thank Tom Monda of Thank You Scientist for the theme song.
Yes, thank you, bro. By Terraformer, out June 14th. Thank You Scientist's new album. It's bonkers, amazing, and you know, you're gonna cream your jeans if you listen to it.
Holy moly, yeah, that's a strong recommendation.
I should say that. I think that's their tagline or something.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. Well, that'll be it for this week on Panning the Stream. Bonk, as always, thank you so much for joining
me. Thank you, Dan. Thanks for being just an amazing host, a doting husband, a quality guy, a great friend, a lovable cutie.
Goodness gracious.
I could go on, but I'm not going to.
Well, you're too nice. And you are an absolute delight to be on this podcast with, as well as all the marital, you know, hanging out and being in love and spending time together and going on vacation and all that. You're just an absolute delight. And thanks for continuing to be that.
Yeah, of course.
Yep. And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us each and every week. We'll be back next week. Goodbye.
Bye.